First thing we want to do, though, is to welcome Doug Hoffer to our area. He's Vermont's state auditor, has been in that job for about a decade now, and he is out with a new report. And Mr. Auditor, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Dave. Not a decade, 7.5 years.
Oh, is that all? Time...
Time fly, yeah.
Right. Yeah, time slows down when you're having a good time or something like that. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, here we go. So, Auditor Hoffer, OneCare, this interesting sort of a new feature of Vermont's healthcare landscape. What is it, and how is it functioning? I mean, you sort of did this introductory report. So what did you find so far?
Well, first of all, let me say that it's not that new. It was founded 6 or 7 years ago, primarily by what was then Fletcher Allen, now University of Vermont Medical Center, and Dartmouth Hitchcock. And they participated in some shared savings programs for 3 years, 3.5 years or so. And then the state, along with the federal government, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, and all the parties, particularly this ACO, this Accountable Care Organization, the only one remaining, agreed via a number of contracts to enter into this new model. It's called the all-payer model. And the intent is for all of the entities which pay for medical services, typically on our behalf in Vermont, that's Medicare, Medicaid, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and one or two other smaller entities, would all effectively pool their resources, and we would attempt to shift from the traditional fee-for-service model, which everyone agreed was really not meeting our needs for a variety of reasons in terms of access and cost and so forth, and basically try to shift to a value-based system where they would pay healthcare providers, doctors and others, to manage our health rather than just provide services and you pay for each one as they pile up. And it's not a bad idea conceptually. In fact, it's probably a good idea. You could take it further and go to single payer, but that's not what this is. So they started work after all the contracts were signed with the intent of getting more and more Vermonters into the system. And they had hoped that in each case they would come in below the annual estimate of what they should spend to meet their goals. So if you have 100,000 people in the system, they were going to provide you with a certain amount of money, and at the end of the year they would say, okay, how did you do? Did you spend more than was expected or less? And if it was less and you saved money on paper, then those entities, those providers, would get to share in some of those savings. If you spent more and did not meet the target, then you would be responsible for a portion of that overage.
Who would be responsible?
The hospital in particular.
Okay, I got it.
Right. So this organization, OneCare is the name of the organization, represents its member entities, which are primarily UVMMC and Dartmouth-Hitchcock, but also all the other hospitals in the state except one, and a number of other independent providers. So it's a big deal. It's a very, very big deal. And the contract for 2020 was for $1.4 billion.
Part of the art here, I would think, is actually predicting ahead of time how much you're going to spend on healthcare and trying to set a target. And what happens when a pandemic hits?
Well, that kind of screwed everything up, but you raised a very good question. The estimate of how much would be the appropriate amount is absolutely essential to the core of this system. And I have a real concern about that, not so much the nuts and bolts, because I think DVA, the Department of Vermont Health Access, which is the entity in state government that has the contract, because they do Medicaid with CMS directly, which is most of the information that we got for this audit. But there was an assumption in the very beginning of this process that 3.5% annual growth would be acceptable. And I think a lot of people in the industry, in the healthcare industry, said, well, that makes sense because for many, many years, not every year, but for most years, the annual growth was a lot more than that. So they saw 3.5 as a reasonable target and would unquestionably a reduction in the rate of growth. However, in my view, they made a fundamental error. And I think it's a fatal flaw, frankly, and that is they based that figure, among other things, primarily on the rate of the state's gross domestic product change over time. And, you know, to people who aren't numbers people, that might sound good. However, the gross domestic product for the state is not correlated with people's ability to pay. I mean, think of yourself and the people you know and your family and friends. How many of them routinely get 3.5% increase in their income every year? They don't. So an awful right. lot of people are falling behind this target, which they is built into the system. And in my view, was a mistake at the very outset. I mean, you think, for example, although it's not a perfect analogy, you think of climate change and all the people who 20, 30 years ago said, oh boy, what are we going to do? Well, they didn't say we have to just reduce the rate of growth in CO2. They said we have to go back 30 years. We have to cut it. And furthermore, the 3.5, as just to get back to that, embedded in the prices that we start this process with are decades of rapid growth in healthcare costs for people that we know is unsustainable. So I happen to think that's a problem. And as they go forward to negotiate the next five-year contract, which they're going to do, in my opinion, prematurely, because they don't have the data to determine whether they should, I'm going to recommend to them that they reconsider that figure, and I'm going to give them some data to suggest why it makes sense to do that.
And, I mean, how wise do you think it is to try to set a figure like that? I can't imagine it was ever considered to be cast in stone, but it also seems to be something that would be subject to a lot of influences, including, I was almost maybe being one quarter facetious or something when I said what happens when a pandemic hits, but I mean, also there are rates of inflation, there are, other sort of exogenous factors that I would imagine could slide in and really have a big influence over a single year's performance in this regard, and I just sort of wonder, is this something that
well, the pandemic is a tremendous outlier for sure. Put that aside for the moment.
Yeah, right.
But in any normal year, the premise mm-hmm. is that we know we have a huge amount of data. They do on people's health and how many people get sick and what yep. diseases and ailments they have. And a huge amount of data on what is typically spent to address those concerns. And we know that in the fee-for-service system, people were getting a lot of tests and a lot of care that probably wasn't as efficient or an effective way to solve the problem. And furthermore, and arguably at least as important, is prevention. So to the extent, and this shows up in some of the quality measures, to the extent that you can vastly increase people's access to care before they get sick or really sick, then you can save a bunch of money in the process. And that all makes sense. Our concern was that there doesn't seem to be enough data about how they're doing. And we can see clearly that in the 3 years of the shared savings program and in the 2 years that we have data for of the current all-payer model, they're losing money a lot more than they're saving, a lot more. And furthermore, another interesting aspect of the program is that in the annual calculation of whether they made the nut or not, whether they saved money or spent more than was expected, they don't include the administrative costs of OneCare. Now, in fact, of course, right this year it's about $19 million. That's not much money in the scheme of things because we spend $6 billion a year on healthcare and the contract's 1.4. But the point is, that's money that wasn't in the system before, and that entity directly does not provide healthcare services. And furthermore, and this is one of our recommendations, even though you don't have all the data on quality, because sometimes that's going to take a generation to determine whether these things are working as expected, shouldn't you start now and measure the so-called net savings, if there are any, against the costs? And we certainly know the costs of the administrative part of OCV, and they refuse to do that. I'm not quite sure why.
I mean, and there is this sense that transparency has been an issue here because my understanding is the OneCare is technically a for-profit entity, right? And so is it fair to say there's less transparency than there is in other aspects of healthcare?
I think that's partly true. They are regulated, as you know, by the Green Mountain Care Board, and their budget is reviewed and approved every year. But I think the record shows that the board itself has made it clear that they don't want to micromanage this organization. They have a dual mission, the Green Mountain Care Board. They are effectively promoting and regulating. And as we've seen with a number of things recently, with EB-5 and with the Agency of Agriculture and the work we did there on the Best Management Practices Program and so forth, you can't do both. You can't do both well, that's for sure. And that seemed, I think that's part of the problem here. That doesn't make the board and its staff bad people. They're smart, good, well-intentioned people, but I think they're sending a mixed message, and their work is influenced by their understandable desire for this thing to work, but that's not the same as being an arm's-length, independent regulator.
Yeah, it is a strange dual role, and you make interesting analogies to a couple of other parts of I want to say state government on the one hand, but also this conglomeration of really state government and some kind of private interests out there that the old public-private partnership thing sometimes gets pretty tangled. So
yes, it does.
One recommendation. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You were going to say, Doug?
Yeah, there's another aspect to this which is kind of curious, and that is even in those instances where they one part of the program, usually Medicare, comes in below, and on paper mm-hmm. they're saving money. It's kind of interesting because here's another analogy. Again, not perfect, but I think will help make the point. If you have a business or your home and you work with your local utility or Efficiency Vermont, and some money is invested in order to save you money going forward on your electric bill or whatever it might be. So once it's all done and you get your first bill and you say, look, I saved $100. Well, you can't view that $100 monthly savings in isolation. The only way that you were able to save that $100 is because you and Efficiency Vermont or the utility or all of you together invested $4,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a 3 or 4 year payback. So yeah, good for you. You saved $100. But the point is, how long is it going to take? What is the payback in the life cycle of those investments? And, you know, this system, the all-payer model, didn't just pop up on day one. The state of Vermont and a lot of the players have been investing money in hopes of making this work for a number of years. And, in fact, we're talking about whether we want to try to do a full accounting of all of the state and federal money that's been expended on this. That's the only way you can determine. You can't say, hey, in this year, we saved $1.2 million. Well, okay, but how many years at that level will it take to pay off the, pick a number, $40, $50, $100 million that were spent to get here? Quite apart from the fact that they don't even count One Care Vermont's administrative costs. So there's lots of things to talk about here. And you know, I don't think anybody would disagree with the desire to make the system more accessible to people and less expensive. But this is just one approach to it. And by the way, there are lots of accountable care organizations that have been organized all over the country in almost every state. This is the only one, to my knowledge, that is singular. Now, we are a small state. If you were to go to Boston, I think there's a handful of ACOs in the same city. So there's competition. Mm-hmm. There is no competition here for this at all. And the literature is pretty clear on that monopolies typically don't lead to lower prices.
One thing that I noted in some of what you were you released yesterday was there seems to be a concern about, I guess I'm thinking of it as the setting of low bars. In other words, we set performance targets, but the performance targets in some cases seem kind of easy or seem to be already being achieved. In other words, you're not squeezing better performance out of anybody. In some instances, is that fair?
Second recommendation, indeed, and I think they're aware of that. And I wouldn't be surprised if they make some changes to that. And I don't think that was done intentionally, but they, until we brought it up, I wasn't aware. I could be wrong. I wasn't aware of them identifying it as a problem to be resolved. But now I think we've got their attention, and maybe they'll make a change.
Yeah, I'm on a strict diet. I'm on a strict diet. I'm going to get it down to 5,000 calories a day or something. And I don't know if that's quite fair, but, you know.
Yeah, no, there are some other things that are a little curious. One quality measure said, we'd like you to reduce, I think it was a suicide rate, to this a certain number per 100,000, or the state's ranking will be between 7th and 20th, something like that, in the country. But if you use that as a metric, then what if everybody else goes down, or looks worse, I should say? Then what have you achieved? You know what I mean?
Yep.
So
I do, and I mean, in other words, if suicide rates went up in other states and then they went up in Vermont and you were supposed to rank in a certain place, you wouldn't really be achieving anything. This though kind of brings to mind a difficult aspect of public administration in general, and I see this all the time in education. And you know, I mean, a doctor could talk to a patient until the doctor is blue in the face about you need to drink less, you need to eat better, you need to exercise more, but the patient's actually got to do it, you know. And I mean, I make this point a lot when talking about schools, because the kids got to do their homework too. You know, we can't blame bad performance all on teachers. And
assume that they have the necessary skills to do that without help.
Yeah.
So you can acknowledge that problem and then address it. And to some extent, the system is intended to do that. There are a number of, not that many, but a number of community health programs, I forget the term of art at the moment, that are intended to address those kinds of issues and others. How you coordinate care, how you get people care at the right time in the right way, and in their neighborhood as opposed to making them travel long distance. All that stuff, that's good, that's helpful, but it also costs money, and I'm not sure that's included in the calculus of whether they saved or lost money in a given year. But that is part of the program, and rightfully so.
Yeah, and you know, I guess the, tell me what you think about the long-term kind of future of One Care. Is this gonna? I mean, it could be that we are still in the early stages of it. I know you told me it's 6 years old or something, but it seems to be to have been established to some degree in fits and starts, and maybe, I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe there's just a more measure of the attention I've been paying to it or something. But I sort of wonder whether it is a model which is you think is worth pursuing and continuing to invest in on the part of the state, or should
it be? Well,
that
remains to be seen. Our point is that we need more data. But I think the question, if I can jump off from your question, is much mm-hmm. bigger than whether One Care and the all-payer model is the answer. I think what's happened with a bunch of the smaller hospitals around Vermont should cause us to ask much bigger questions, like, you know, do we need 14 hospitals that all provide most of the same services? Can that be sustained? And I think some people would say, boy, that's a good question, and the answer might be no. I'm not a healthcare professional. I can't answer the question, but it seems to me that that is an issue that should be discussed by people in those communities, people in Montpelier, and all over the state. It's a big deal. People want and need access to care where they live. They don't want to have to travel forever to get to it, although this is a rural state, let's be honest. But I think they are asking themselves, how can we continue in this way? And I suspect that some of those hospitals are going to be scratching their head, even when we come out of the pandemic, about how can we keep paying the dues, because all the hospitals have to pay dues to One Care to be part of the system. And I'm just not sure if the system we have, the healthcare infrastructure, not dissimilar in concept to the state colleges, you know, that built out with an expectation that each of those schools would be everything to everyone. I'm oversimplifying mm-hmm. it, of course. But yeah. Maybe we should have that conversation about hospital infrastructure as well.
Yeah, and it's a slightly different degree of kind of pixels on the screen, but you could almost say the same thing about our public schools and the design of our K-12 system here. Obviously, that's been going through a lot of questioning in recent years. Along the same lines, is the infrastructure matched well to the population, essentially? And I get what you mean. I don't know exactly what the answers are, and obviously, I guess if I did, I'd be... I don't know
what.
You
have a different kind of radio show, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. And I'd be asking fewer questions and making more pronouncements or something, I don't know. But my guest is Auditor Doug Hoffer. He's come out with a new report. Tells us the first in a series on the One Care Affordable Care Organization, which is trying to restructure the way Vermont pays for health care. and organizes healthcare to some extent. And I guess I'm sort of curious as to, you know, I was starting to ask that question, Doug, as to whether you think this thing has long-term sustainability, whether this is the proper way to organize healthcare, you know, looking ahead 10 years or something like that, 20 years, who knows?
And better coordination and collaboration is a no-brainer. The question is, okay, can it be sustained financially? And I think using the back to that 3.5%, using that, the answer to me is clearly no. There's no way that we can continue to have healthcare eat this much of our entire economy. It's up to almost 20% of the state's economy. That's not just Vermont. But I can say that, you know, where we were in the 90s, I remember clearly during the Howard Dean years, Vermont's per capita healthcare expenditures were one of the lowest in the country. That's not where we are today. And I won't say more about that now because we have a smallish report coming out in maybe a week or week and a half that will address that more directly.
Well, I'm going to look forward to that because one of the questions I have about that is just healthcare costs are going to rise as people age, right? I mean, that's another aspect of this thing is that Vermont, I think the last I looked, had the second lowest or second oldest population in the country, only to Maine. And so, you know,
don't assume, by the way, the literature is mixed on that. Demographics are not necessarily correlated with increased prices.
I don't mean even increased prices, but what about increased utilization? Just
well, there's no
more
question
people.
That this, yeah, that there's a smallish percentage of older Americans that do utilize a great deal of care, and it costs a lot of money. No question about it. But that doesn't mean that that has to continue. Part of what, to their credit, part of what the all payer model ACO folks, not just here but all over, are focused on is, you know, how can we address that? And it has to do with people's quality of life, not just money. There's a lot of reasons that this is something we should be talking about, for sure.
But, I mean, I guess, you know, the thing I'm trying to get to is, first off, am I right that more people in their 70s go to the hospital with heart attacks than in their 50s or 40s?
Well, actually, to the extent, I don't know. I haven't looked at that data.
Okay.
To the extent that that is related to diabetes and obesity and all that stuff, that is all over the age spectrum, not just elder.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I think that's another one of these factors that probably my hunch is, and, you know, I haven't done the research to really back this up, but my hunch is that that's one of the factors in healthcare costs is just, you know, which population are you looking at? I mean, people talk about young people often going out without insurance, and they can kind of get away with it in a lot of cases for a while anyway. And, you know that whole story. Hey, Doug Hoffer, we are just about out of time on this segment of the Dave Graham Show. We got to stay on top of this, though. How many more parts of this series are you going to come out with?
Well, we're going to start another job shortly. We have the other report coming out in a week or two, and I'll keep you posted.
All right. Doug Hoffer, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Dave.
State Auditor Doug Hoffer on the Accountable Care Organization, rather. And, hey, we're going to go to a bottom-of-the-hour break for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors, and we'll be back with more of the Dave Graham Show in just a couple minutes, folks. Stay with us.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and we are trying to squeeze in some segments devoted to introducing some of our candidates for statewide office to our listening audience here. And we have had a number of folks on the program so far, and today is the turn for Miriam Berry. She is a Republican congressional candidate. She is a first-time office seeker, works, I believe, as a registered nurse in long-term care, and is looking to go to Washington to replace long-term incumbent Peter Welch, who's a Democrat, first elected in 2006. And Miriam Berry, I do believe, is on the phone with us this morning. Ms. Berry, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Glad to do it. So tell us, first off, why are you running for Congress?
For me personally, the timing is right, but also I want to bring a sensible voice to our deeply country. I think that especially in the time of COVID, it might be useful to have somebody in the medical field. Also, as a taxpayer, I value where people's money is going, and I think we need to be responsible stewards of that. I also think that I'm able to bring fight against that partisan bickering. I kind of don't like how, or I hate how special interest groups seem to jump at every tragedy to promote their own agendas, and I don't like how so many of those are pages and pages. I believe every law should be easily understood. I'd rather read 10 different laws that take 10 minutes apiece than one law that takes over an hour to read. That's just a starting point for you.
Yeah. Hey, I wonder if you can get to a little bit of a better spot or something. Your cell phone is jumping in and out just a little bit. I might have missed a keyword or two, so if I seem to have missed something in your introductory remarks there, I apologize. But I don't know if you can get near a window or something where you have a slightly better signal, but that would be excellent if possible.
Oh, okay.
What are you doing as far as your campaign? I mean, obviously, it's a tough time to be launching a political campaign, the traditional getting out on the hustings and going to rallies and all that kind of stuff. Not really as much a thing during the COVID crisis as in a typical political year. So how are you handling the campaigning aspect of this amid the COVID crisis?
Right now, it's been mostly internet presence. I do have a website and talking to different people to see where their needs are and how I can help them on the national level.
And I'm wondering, in terms of some of the specific issues you mentioned, being a good steward of the taxpayers' money. We do have a very, very large federal deficit and federal debt. It has had two big jumps during the past couple of years of the Trump administration. The first, of course, the tax cuts at the end of 2017, which have been described as adding about $1 trillion to the federal debt. And now with the COVID crisis, there's been all these efforts by the Congress and the executive to pump some money into the economy and keep it afloat, even though there's been this shutdown, etc. More debt being added to the pile. What do you think about all that? What would you do about it? I guess I'll break it down. First off, were the tax cuts a wise idea?
I believe they were.
And how would you respond to this concern that they end up adding to the federal debt, long-term debt?
Sure. I think that with the tax cuts, it's an effort to get businesses employing more people employing more people, and then in the long run, with employing more people, increase the tax revenues. I understand that with a balanced budget, that it was ruled unconstitutional, but the balanced budget, striving for it is certainly a good thing. Understanding that sometimes the country does need to run in a deficit in order to get ourselves back up on our feet.
Yeah, I mean, all of that is a matter of degree, I would think.
Sure.
And you, you know, running in a deficit is one thing. How large a deficit you want to run is always the consideration. And do you agree with the general sort of the second part of that, the debt issue here, which is the amount that has been added this year in response to the coronavirus crisis? Do you agree with the steps that have been taken by the Congress and the Trump administration this year to, as I say, try to keep the economy afloat?
Yes, I do. I think these are drastic times, or severe times, and so we have to look at things with a different eye, as we haven't encountered something like this in a century.
Yeah, it's certainly it is. These are unusual times for sure. Let me get a sense of some of the sort of, I mean, people talk about them as the social issues out there. Let's talk about immigration for a moment. Do you consider yourself a hawk on immigration? Are we being too tough? Are we being not tough enough on folks coming into the country? Where do you come down in immigration?
With immigration, I definitely feel that people from various cultures and countries can benefit us. I do lean towards legal immigration, that people go through the process. I do favor strong borders, especially in these times where we need to heal as a country versus taking on more people, more immigrants that may not be documented, illegal immigrants. That's adding to a tough space right now.
The border wall that the president has been trying to build, do you support that?
Yes, I do.
And do you feel as though that is the real key to managing immigration, or are there other methods that could be used that people say that most of the illegal immigration actually still occurs through official border points, which I think physically are sort of gaps in the wall that which are guarded and are staffed by federal authorities, but do you feel like the wall is the most effective way, or is it more of a symbol?
I do lean towards it being symbolic. And I think that having the adequate staffing for the borders and the crossing points is important as well.
Let's talk for a moment about abortion and pro-life, pro-choice issues, and all that sort of thing. Where do you come down on that issue?
Well, at this point, we know abortion itself has been handed to the states, but they are medical procedures, and I do feel that they should be regulated as any other medical procedure, whether it's informed consent and looking at viability as well. I personally am opposed to abortion, and I would like to see as little as possible.
Would you like to see it eliminated entirely?
I would. But I do understand that it has been handed to the states. I believe in providing education and support to moms who are facing a crisis pregnancy.
And in terms of the U.S. Supreme Court and the jurisprudence surrounding this, of course, we just had a ruling which in which the court said that a Louisiana law, which was a lot of folks considered to be essentially designed to make it more difficult to obtain an abortion. It was less about the details of the law, which had to do with an abortion clinics, physicians having privileges at local hospitals. The law said in Louisiana that you must have privileges at a local hospital. The way this was explained to me the other day was that the... that's actually a pretty rare thing, because most abortions do not end up having the patient go to the hospital. And so there's limited exposure there, limited reason for the physician on staff at an abortion clinic to have privileges at a local hospital. And so it's sort of a disconnect there. And I wonder, do you think that the court decided this the right way in terms of striking down that Louisiana law, or do you think that do you wish it had settled on it the other way?
I think that the law was a good law because, granted, the statistics might be low that somebody might need hospitalization, but when somebody has had a potentially dangerous procedure going on, that the doctor should be able to directly admit instead of trying to go through the emergency and just to get that person to the hospital to have her needs taken care of. The risks, I think, are still quite great for whether it's a perforated uterus or bleeding, that it's good for a doctor to have the admitting privileges and get that person right to the hospital.
And that process is speeded up if you don't have to basically stop at the emergency room first. It sounds like where you're going with this. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see here. And I'm just wondering. You know, we hear a lot of discussion about, especially from the pro-choice side of the debate, about a woman's right to choose and women's autonomy. You are a woman. What do you think of those arguments?
I think that there are many steps before pregnancy, and that I think that and once somebody's pregnant, then the choices have already been made. And so I really believe that abortion shouldn't be the instant answer to an unplanned pregnancy.
Okay. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about environmental policy. I'm wondering... Trump administration, and by the way, I should be clear here. You told me the other day you are generally a supporter of President Trump. You plan to vote for him in November, that's the case, right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, are there any possible issues that arise from time to time that make you sort of scratch your head and go, here's one example. It's just new this week. This president is alleged to have known about Russian intelligence offering bounties for the deaths of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. And it said that he knew this and didn't do anything about it. Hasn't done anything still now that it's public, and that it's public that he knew about it earlier on. You okay with that?
I still don't believe that he knew about it before the other people did.
Before who?
I think the truth will come out. You know, we read about it in the news this week, and so he may have known about it before we did, but I don't think he knew about it before these men were killed.
Let me ask you, okay, so he didn't know about it before the men were killed. I understand how that would work, because it's not really an issue unless you have people who are dying and then you find out that they were dying because somebody put a bounty on their heads and that helped prompt their killing. So the president learns at some point earlier on than this week, certainly, and earlier on than the general public, that there is this practice going on of bounties being paid, and should he have taken steps to make it public, A, and B, to go to Vladimir Putin and say, cut it out, and, you know, this is outrageous, stop it?
It would make sense that when he heard about it, he would move forward with it.
Okay. The president's, you're in healthcare. I'm just wondering now, as a healthcare professional, what do you think about the president's handling of the coronavirus crisis? Do you think he's done a good job with this?
I think he has. I think that unfortunately, we're still learning a whole lot about the coronavirus 19. Initially, we were, even from healthcare, we were changing sometimes a few times a day what we were learning. Now we've we've got a pretty good knowledge base, but I still have questions about it.
I was going to ask about wearing masks, because the president has been a skeptic about masks. He hasn't been wearing one much himself for most of the period during which the coronavirus has been with us. And in fact, he, in a couple of instances, has sort of ridiculed reporters for wearing masks to news conferences and so on. Do you think that mask wearing, you know, you're, as a health professional, do you urge and people to wear masks while in public?
What I do personally is I do wear a mask when I'm in public because I want to protect other people. So that's my motivation, being that I have worked in a COVID facility, that I think it's my responsibility to offer that extra layer of protection. I do know that you have to wear them appropriately, for example, over the nose and not be touching your face, all those basics. So for myself, I definitely think that wearing a mask is good. Whether we should pass laws that say so, that I'm still trying to decide, you know, individual rights versus...
If it's good practice, though, to wear a mask, should the president of the United States wear a mask and promote wearing a mask just as a matter of public policy? I mean, I think back to President Kennedy, who had this President's Council on Physical Fitness and promoted the idea of people staying in shape and never passed a law to that effect and left it to people's personal liberty and so on, but still was out there in public saying it's a great idea to go out and get some exercise. I mean, the president has a role there, I think, as a teacher, as a, you know, they talk about the bully pulpit and so on. And the president has set an example of being rather disdainful toward masks. Wise or unwise?
It's his choice. I can't go further than that. I don't know his situation. It may be that everybody around him is screened beforehand. I don't know. I can't really go further on that one.
Yeah, and of course, then yesterday he came out and he said that he's now warming up to masks. He thinks they may be a good idea after all. He tried one out and it made him look like the Lone Ranger. Did you hear that news?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, he apparently he was on Fox Business being interviewed about it, and he made these comments where he thought that wearing a mask made him look like the Lone Ranger. And obviously the most important thing about wearing a mask is not its sort of fashion statement or its ability to improve one's own performance, or appearance, rather. Is it? It's mainly a health thing, isn't it?
I think it's a health thing, but it's kind of fun seeing all the people that have personalized their own masks. Certainly surgical masks are much more protective than the cloth ones. The cloth ones still will contain a sneeze or a cough. But I do like that people are making their own fashion statements with the mask. Kind of fun.
Yeah, and speaking of different styles of masks, of course, I don't know if you recall much about the Lone Ranger, but I was looking up pictures of it, the Lone Ranger, this morning, and the Lone Ranger's mask was around the eyes. And so we want a mask over the nose and mouth, right, for coronavirus? Yep. Yeah.
It's possible, you know, eye protection, but that makes it kind of hard for some folks. I wear glasses,
yeah.
So that helps me.
Miriam Berry, I'm wondering, give us a couple of examples of why you think the incumbent congressman should be replaced.
I think that it's a time to have, well, for one, a Republican in there, but somebody who's not always going to stick with the party lines in the sense of, okay, this is what the Democrats are doing. We condemn the president. We go along our agendas. I think that it will be good to have somebody who's not a professional candidate be in office there. I believe that the House of Representatives was created specifically to allow people to come in to serve their community and then go out at a certain time rather than staying there for a lifetime.
How many terms would you serve in Congress if you won the seat and were getting reelected term after term?
Yeah, that's a good question. I want to keep up my RN license, for example, so I want to definitely be hearing from my from my constituents what they want as well. If I'm in a committee, for example, that's going to look at something long-term, then I would try to stay long-term or longer-term. But I don't think that I would want to do it for 10 years, for example.
Okay. Another big issue that has arisen recently, of course, concerns race relations in America.
Sure.
Miriam Berry, what do you think about the Black Lives Matter as a sort of political rallying cry or slogan?
A couple thoughts there. I do want to distinguish the idea of Black Lives Mattering from the Black Lives Matter Global Network, the organization. What I really would address is that Black Lives, I hear that they matter is, yes, it's a heart's cry, but really what I would say to a person of color is, like, I want to say so much more than Black Lives Matter, that your life is precious, that your life counts, that you are special. And I would want to go much further than Black Lives Matter. It may be semantics, but I don't think we have to have a divisive thing about Black lives. We're a multiracial country, multi-ethnic. We have all sorts of beliefs, and it just makes our world so much more wonderful when we have this variety. I do think that we need to work for justice for all people. So I may disagree with the political movement, how they're approaching things, but I do say definitely that Black lives are precious and really count to me.
And do you feel as though the response to the George Floyd killing in particular has been too much? Has it been about right? Has it been, do you understand where some of the anger and outrage are coming from?
I certainly understand the anger and outrage. I don't agree with the violence that's ensued from it. I want to work towards healing a nation rather than tit for tat and this for that and escalation. To resolve
okay.
things kindly will require time, but it does require dialogue.
For sure. Well, Miriam Berry, unfortunately, I got to say we are out of time for dialogue this morning because I've got to go to a top of the hour break in the next segment. I thank you very much for joining me this morning. Nice chatting
well,
with you.
Thank you so
and,
much for having me, Mr. Grimm.
Good luck on the campaign trail. We'll talk soon. Take care. All right, let's go to a top of the hour break for some CBS News here on the Dave Grimm Show on WDEV FM and AM. Act 250 in the second hour. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Grimm Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are continuing into our second hour here on the 2nd of July, Thursday morning, and we were going to have a CBS News correspondent join us this morning, as we often do after the mid-show break, but unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to describe it, they have decided to have that journalist go and attend a just announced a news conference with President Donald Trump. So I sort of understand why that person might be busy. You know, news happens. This is how it goes sometimes in the world of news and radio and et cetera. And we can open the phone lines for the next few minutes and invite listeners to join us. I wonder whether anybody is a fan of the old Lone Ranger show. The president yesterday said that he's warming up to the idea of wearing masks. He earlier on has been rather disdainful toward wearing masks, and a lot of folks think that has contributed to a phenomenon in the country where people are are disdaining masks sometimes for political reasons. And in fact, I've seen it written and said and heard it said that, you know, Democrats are wearing masks and Republicans are not, which I think the idea of taking a public health measure or not for political reasons is just mind-bogglingly stupid, frankly. I don't understand why anybody would. I don't really like wearing a mask, but I wear a mask because it is considered to be a public health measure. It's sort of like I wear glasses because they help me see better. If I wear a mask and it helps me have less risk of spreading the coronavirus, that's okay too. Just sort of, I don't know why politics has to enter in here. Apparently it has. And anyway, you'll be glad to know that the President of the United States yesterday said that he's starting to like masks. He thinks that he wore one recently, and he said it made him look like the Lone Ranger. He may have a little bit of a confused memory about the Lone Ranger's mask. Of course, I looked at a picture of, you know, standard stock picture of the old Lone Ranger this morning online, and sure enough, my memory was correct that the Lone Ranger's mask was around the eyes. A COVID-19 mask, if you wear it around the eyes, is not going to provide you with the same level of protection, or won't provide others from you with the same level of protection as a mask over your nose and mouth. So just a little bit of nuance to that, I guess, sort of piece of public health advice from the President of the United States. But it's the nose and the mouth that really matter here, folks, not the eyes. So maybe the Lone Ranger mask. I don't know. Anyway, or it could be the President is confusing his Old West characters. There were some, I remember, in movies and so on. Sometimes it was the stick-up artist who would go around with a mask over the nose and mouth. But in this case, the President seems to think that the mask made him look like the Lone Ranger. I hope he was wearing it right, that it wasn't up around his eyes. Hope he's just maybe has a little bit of a faulty memory on what the mask actually looked like on the Lone Ranger. So there you go. But I'm wondering if people out there are going to rethink, if anybody out there has been reluctant to wear a mask because they think, I don't know what, it's a politically correct liberal plot or something to force compliance on the masses. Now that the President seems to be warming up to the idea, does that change your thinking at all? That would be one question for folks who have been reluctant to wear a mask and have pointed at the fact that the President often has not worn one and is occasionally actually sort of picked on reporters at news conferences for wearing masks while they're doing their work. And I'm just not clear on why this thing had to become political at all to begin with. I think it may be a sign that the that ideology is just injecting itself or being injected by some people into aspects of our daily lives where it really doesn't need to be. It's become almost too big a thing. And there are times when it makes more sense, I think, to try to figure out what the facts are, maybe in this case what the science is, what the public health officials are recommending, and say it doesn't really matter whether I'm a liberal or a conservative. But if it seems to be a factual matter that it's smarter to wear a mask, then I'll wear a mask. I mean, the other aspect of this thing, which I've mentioned before, of course, is that when we think about the people who are most honored in our society, especially when they put their lives on the line, and I'm thinking of police officers and military personnel, firefighters, they wear a lot of gear every day in the name of protecting other people. And I sort of feel like if I really want to honor those folks who put their lives on the line for us, I could gear up to the extent of wearing a little piece of cloth over my nose and mouth. I believe we have Gary on the line from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Hey, this wearing the mask thing is a subject that's near and dear to my heart, actually.
How's that?
I've been thinking about it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, back years ago, They come up with no shoes, no shirt, no service.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because of a health risk.
Yep.
If you remember right.
I do.
Now, all of a sudden, I didn't hear anybody complain about their constitutional rights then. They just did it.
Yep.
Because it was a health risk.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're in the same situation now. And I think a lot of it is these people are not educated. And I can wear a mask that protects them.
Yeah.
It doesn't do anything for me.
Right.
And they need to start showing respect for their fellow citizens, for crying out loud. Come on. You know, I agree with the mask thing completely. And I was in Hannaford the other day. I had a mask on. Little mm-hmm. old lady in front of me starts sneezing, takes her mask off, blows her nose, and never put her mask back up, put the Kleenex in her pocket, and got up to the teller and sneezed about four more times all over the
place. Oh, my word. Yikes.
Oh, my word, yes. And, I mean, it's, come on, folks. You know, we're not kindergartners. This is serious stuff.
And well, Gary, I think actually that your point about the no shirt, no shoes, no service signs, they date from an age, and it wasn't long ago. It was probably 10 or 20, 30 years ago when I started seeing signs like that. They date from an age when ideology was not injected into everything. People just sort of looked at that as a public health rule. And didn't really think that it mattered who I'm voting for president
right.
in terms of whether I follow that rule or not. You know, these days the question that am I going to wear a mask seems to be tied to who am I going to vote for president, and I frankly find that to be not a very healthy development in our society that we have to attach politics to stuff like that.
No, it isn't, and you know. These people, I don't think that they realize that they can give it to other people, even if the other people are wearing a mask. And how would you feel if you're a 26-year-old, and I'm invincible, and I'm not wearing a mask, and nobody's going to make me? It's my constitutional right. And you go home and give the coronavirus to their grandmother, and she drops dead in 2 weeks. How are they going to feel then?
Well, there's that question, and then
that's your constitutional right to kill their grandmother.
Why don't I have a constitutional right to? Why don't I have a constitutional right to drive down the left-hand side of the road if that's what I feel like doing?
Right. I mean, it's getting ridiculous, and now they're closing states down again. Oh man.
Yep. Yep.
I just wish everybody would just, you know, come on, folks.
Anyway,
deal with some reality here.
Reality. What a concept. Hey, Gary, thank you for the call. I got to move on, but interesting perspective there. So thanks for checking in. Do so again soon, please. And there was very rapid development and growth and building going on down in southern Vermont in particular with the ski area development happening and a lot of new buildings going up. Related to ski lodgings and so on. And Governor Dean Davis was involved in an effort to get all of this under control to some extent. And there was the passage of Act 250, a land use law which has been in effect in Vermont ever since. And it is either hit or about to hit its half a century mark. And folks have been thinking for the past couple of years, it probably bears a look to see whether it needs some tinkering, some updating, et cetera. And sure enough, big efforts have been underway in that regard in the legislature. And we wanted to catch up on how they're coming and what the issues are on the table. And we have three folks who have been expert in Act 250 for some a number of years, and I guess they vary in number of years doing this, but we're going to talk about Act 250, the land use law, in the next segment here of the Dave Graham Show. Christopher Bray is a senator, a Democratic senator, state senator from Madison County. He chairs the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee. And Senator Bray, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Pleasure to be joining you again, Dave. Thanks.
And Ed Stanek is a longtime administrator in the District Commission for Act 250, covering Central Vermont. I believe he was based in Barrie for a long time. Ed, you are retired from that position now. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And thank you very much for joining me as well.
Thank you for having me. I hope I can contribute to this conversation in a meaningful way.
All righty. John Grobman is with the Vermont Natural Resources Council. VNRC has taken an interesting role here. They announced earlier this year, before the pandemic hit, back in, I think, January or so, that they had struck an agreement with the Scott administration about changes to Act 250. Left some people scratching their heads and saying, here we have an environmental group which is joining forces with a Republican gubernatorial administration. But they have they said they had worked out a good compromise on some of the features that Act 250 should have going forward, and VNRC has been very involved in developments since then. And John Grobman is on the phone with us as well. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Dave. And just I had a really hard time hearing Ed Stanek. I don't know if that was the case for anybody else, but I heard Senator Bray very clearly.
Oh, okay. We'll I'm sure the just got from our booth there, from our studio over in Waterbury, that we're trying to fix it.
I just wanted to say it was hard to hear, and I want to hear what Ed has to say.
Yep, sure. Yeah. So, I'll start with Senator Bray, because he's in the catbird seat here as the chair of the Senate Natural Resources Committee. And Senator, we don't yet have completed legislation ready to go to the governor's desk, but there's contemplation that we're going to resume these efforts when lawmakers return to their business in August. Tell us where things stand now. What are the principal features of the Act 250 update bill as it currently stands?
Sure. So thanks for taking this up, because Act 250 is really essential to the look and feel of the state of Vermont. It's been a great planning tool. Sometimes we're so used to it being there that we fail to appreciate how much it's really helped the state. So as you pointed out leading in, you know, it's turning 50. It was passed in 1970, and Vermont's changed a lot. So this was there was a commission created. It actually had its first meeting back in September 20th of 2017. And then it worked for about 2 years, putting together, I have a 4-inch thick binder full of all the recommendations that came out of that. That led to a bill in the House that started a year and a half ago, H-926, and that is the bill where the Senate is currently working on. So 926 came over to the Senate this spring. Once we had bandwidth, our first order of business when it arrived was responding to COVID, because we had just shut down the State House. Then we took it up, and we worked on it this spring. We voted out of Natural Resources and Energy because it affects revenues of the state. It's currently now it's in a finance. We'll be back to the State House we'll be back in session. I don't think we'll be physically present on August 25th to finish up our work for the year, and I expect it to be out of Senate Finance within that first week. And the bill itself, overall, it aims to do is embrace the state's notions of smart growth. Development in downtown centers, village centers, and keeping those centers compact, and then keeping the beautiful green landscape around green and beautiful and working as well. So there are provisions that are oriented to housing and development in towns through Act 250 and also through municipal planning. It's not all just Act 250. And then there's provisions oriented to the forest, forest products industry, recreational trails, etc., outside of town.
And in terms of the smart growth in the village and city centers, downtowns, do I understand correctly that this bill would exempt those areas from Act 250 review?
Well, so there is a the provisions as proposed now say that areas that are in a get designated as a designated downtown district or designated neighborhood development area. So there's an approval process that you have to go through. Basically, it's another planning process to make sure that we do good planning and development in those particular centers, because you have to do extra work to earn the designation. The argument has been that then layering Act 250 on top of it was duplicative and added time, expense, and little value to the actual kind of building and construction that happened. That was the administration's position, and we worked with a variety of committees as well as the administration and said, okay, there's a provision that allows you to be take an Act 250 permit off a property if you're in one of these new designated areas. But you don't just walk out of Act 250. You have to go through a process whereby, as we've constructed it, the Act 250 Commission itself that originally issued the permit and very likely attached permit conditions to it has to approve any transfer to a municipal permit, including transferring conditions that they believe are still important to managing that property appropriately.
And Ed Stanek, longtime Act 250 administrator, now retired from that position in the central Vermont area. I'm wondering, my recollection about Act 250 and the way it has operated for quite a number of years, if not from the beginning, has been that there have been jurisdictional questions frequently, and that's kind of a threshold thing with Act 250, if I recall, where you you basically first determination is, does Act 250 apply to this project? Do I have that right, first off? And what is your understanding of how that question and its handling will change under the legislation as currently proposed?
Well, Dave, let me just say I had extreme difficulty hearing Senator Bray. I was listening live streaming, but there's that few-minute delay, so I heard some of what the senator said, but not all of it. But I also wanted to start off by saying that I'm extremely grateful. I've told Senator Bray and other senators for all the work they've been doing under the burdens of COVID-19 to make the legislative process work for all of us. And I mean that quite sincerely. It's just that it has not worked out well in terms of Act 250. But to answer your question, Dave, yes, the very first step in state government, both for Act 250, the Agency of Natural Resources, and other agencies, is to tell people if they need to get a permit or not. So the official legal word for that is jurisdiction. 95% of these jurisdictional determinations are made with a checklist. It's black and white as to who needs to get a permit. In the more complicated cases, there's a more detailed discussion of why jurisdiction is required. Just commenting very quickly on the exemptions. The exemptions have been amended to Act 250 for the last 10, 20 years. I understand, the philosophy behind growth in the right place, but now, the essential bottom line question is, does anybody really know if all the existing exemptions have had the desired effect? There's never been a study as to the quality of local review absent Act 250. Unfortunately, there are some poster children out there of how these exemptions may not have the desired effect, and a good example is the hole in downtown Newport. That project did go through a modified Act 250 review under one of the existing exemptions. So, on the theory, on the question of exemptions, I think we should all slow down and see whether or not we're having the desired effects and not rush into this into the current legislative session.
John Grobman of VNRC, let me ask you, John, as kind of an introductory matter here, review for us the agreement with the Scott administration and this what some frankly regarded as kind of a head-scratching move by a green group and getting together with an administration of a party which frankly has been has pushed relaxation in certain aspects of Act 250 for more than a decade now.
Yeah. So yeah, we talked about this once before in your show, Dave. So VNRC, we're not a political organization. We're a 501c3, nonprofit environmental advocacy group. And as Senator Bray noted, we have been in the state talking about changes to Act 250 to recognize that over the last 50 years, there have been changes in the issues that are of concern. There are changes in the regulatory environment, meaning that there are other regulations in place that didn't exist when Act 250 was there. There are changes in terms of what we've seen in terms of what Act 250 has done well and what it hasn't done well. And, we've been, going through that process, grinding through these policies. So is the administration. And, we'll work with anybody on policies that we think make sense. And so the Scott administration came to us, in the last summer and said, based on all the discussions that we've had for years now, as Senator Bray noted, we see a lot of common ground. We see, part of VNRC, we have a program that focuses on smart growth that for years has been saying we need to focus on infilling development, in our designated areas and protecting our forest land and farmland outside of these areas. The administration said that it agreed with that principle, and that was something that was new that we hadn't heard before. Before, certainly the administration supported, having less regulatory review in designated areas, but they hadn't supported protecting forested areas. And so that was that is the foundation for the discussions that ensued about how could we alter Act 250 in a way that seemed to make sense for both VNRC and the administration. Other areas where there was agreement is with recreational trails. The governor believes that recreational trails is going to be an important part of our economy going forward, even before COVID. I think even after COVID, it's seen as an important economic, a sector. And I think from VNRC's perspective and many other groups, it's not just VNRC. We've been working with the Nature Conservancy. We've been working with Vermont Audubon. We've been working with the conservation groups. And we've seen that trail review hasn't worked in Act 250. So it was that.
Let's talk about this more after the break, though, John. I got to interrupt. I'm sorry. I'm being told we need to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. So we'll be back very shortly to continue our conversation.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Thanks for staying with us, folks. We're talking about Act 250. We have 3 very knowledgeable guests, the chair of the Senate Natural Resources Committee, Senator Christopher Bray of Addison County, John Grobman of the Vermont Natural Resources Council, Ed Stanek, who is Act 250 administrator with the District Commission serving Central Vermont based in Barrie for, how long were you there, Ed?
32 years.
That's a pretty good career. And which district is it? Refresh me. What's the number?
District 5, basically Washington and Lamoille counties.
Yeah, okay. So you've been around Act 250 a lot. And when did you finally get done and retire from that job?
2011.
2011, okay. Yeah. But you've continued to follow developments related to Act 250. I guess it's dear to your heart in those years since then. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'm an old-fashioned guy. I feel like the taxpayers paid me to be trained with Act 250 and administered for 32 years. So now as a retired citizen, I felt an obligation to step up to the plate to assist in sorting through this rather complex subject matter. So, yes, I spent a lot of time in the State House during the 2019 session.
Right. John Grobman, I kind of interrupted you, and I apologize for that.
Yeah, no problem. I'll wrap it up.
Okay.
So your question was, you know,
just asking about the kind of the role of BNRC vis-a-vis the Scott administration and the overall approach to reforming Act 250. You were talking about how, you know, there politics aside, there's actually quite a bit of common ground here.
There was, and you know, and so like the core of it is basically what is in the bill that Senator Bray is working on, those are the pieces that really remain. And I think, you know, there's a lot, I think, that the report on the commission that studied the future of Act 250 that Senator Bray referenced identified, you know, many, many issues that really needed to be, you know, addressed to make sure Act 250 is working well into the 21st century and going forward. And the bill that Senator Bray has been working on is really just a sliver of that. But I think it's the issues that have been at the core of where there was some agreement between the Scott administration and VNRC, and where the commission had focused. And this is in looking at Act 250 regulating development in certain designated areas, and what kind of job has Act 250 done in protecting our forested areas in particular, you know, outside of these designated areas. And I think those are the core pieces that really remain kind of as part of, like, still being the foundation for making some changes to Act 250 going forward. So, and Senator Bray could talk some more about those provisions in the bill, but, you know, I think that there's been a lot of misconceptions about the exemptions are not for everywhere. You have to, it only applies to three of the designation programs we have. Those designation programs are going to be improved. They're already pretty good, because there's going to be a recognition that getting the designation will result in not having Act 250 apply there. There's going to be now an appeal to decisions from those designation programs. Right now, you can't appeal those decisions, so there's not accountability, so that's a big change. And right now, there's limited Act 250 review, especially in the downtown and the Village Center areas. There have been, as Stanek referenced, there have been a number of exemptions and alterations to Act 250 over the last 50 years that had lessened the review of projects in these areas. And quite frankly, towns that can, you know, can be awarded these designations, and just having that designation process, you know, part of that is to make sure that we're protecting natural resources in these areas, and that, you know, there does seem to be a logic in that you don't need to duplicate that effort if it's really being handled through another regulatory program. If it goes along with protecting areas outside, you know, so take Act 250's energy and focus it outside of these areas that are not protected. And Act 250 has done a, quite frankly, inconsistent job at best of protecting, you know, areas like our forests and some of the habitat that the forests provide.
Do you feel as though the legislation contains the provisions necessary to really step up protections against forest fragmentation, John Groban?
I think it makes a really great start. I'd like to give Senator Bray a chance to address that, but it basically is taking the forest issues have been debated now independently of even the Commission on Act 250. There have been at least two forest bills, one passed the House, one made it almost all the way through the Senate over the last 2 years, and those are the provisions that are, you know, basically in the bill, and it would add criteria to Act 250 to protect forests, which is a major step forward, and it would add a jurisdictional tool to address some of the development that's right now not under Act 250 that is, you know, allowing for development into these forested areas that are fragmenting forests, harming habitat, and right now is not under Act 250 review.
Okay, I'll get to Senator Bray in just a moment. I wanted to bring in a listener who's called in, George from Middlebury. Good morning, George.
Good morning. So I believe the old existing Act 250 process requires that anybody doing any timber harvesting above 2,500 feet needs to get an Act 250 permit. There was some additional proposed changes to reduce that to a lower elevation, and I'm curious if that is still in the bill.
I think there was talk of lowering that elevation to 1,500 feet. What happened with that, Senator Bray?
Yeah, so that was discussed in the House, and that it was the elevation was not lowered, so the current threshold stands.
at 2,500 feet.
Right.
George, are you still with us?
I am. And that's a, I guess, a good thing, considering some of these mountain towns that have much of their land, which is above 1,500 feet, and a large portion of their rural landscape is basically operated as operational forest land, and most of the properties are under current use review. So my other question would be, is there any proposed changes to agricultural development?
Senator Bray?
No. Short answer would be no. There is a road rule in the bill. It becomes a jurisdictional trigger when you build a new road that's roughly 2,000 feet, 7 football fields long. That creates an opportunity for Act 250 review, but it exempts roads that are related to logging and forestry, municipal roads, utility corridors, things like that. So agriculture.
So basically, it would be a 2,000-foot road to a hunting camp or a house, correct? Is that what you're,
right,
in a nutshell?
Well, doesn't matter. In particular, where it's growing, it's that you end up with long roads being pushed. Of greatest concern is when you start fragmenting large forest blocks by putting in, you know, a road 0.4 mile long. So and if you cross that threshold, then Act 250 kicks in. Some people, and, you know, the important thing to say is, okay, so what happens at that point? Well, if there's an undue adverse impact on the environment, then you're asked to go through a design or process that says, well, can you avoid that fragmentation, or can you reduce it, or can you mitigate it? So it's not a hard stop. It's that when you start breaking up forest blocks and making them less healthy, less productive, et cetera, that that then you should engage in the planning process that can help reduce the negative impacts of that kind of development.
So it doesn't have to do with where it's going to. It just has to do with the fact you're building something 16 feet wide that's more than 2,000 feet long?
I don't believe there. You don't specify width, but right. So new construction for existing roads that already are 2,000 feet or longer, they're not impacted by this. So we're talking about new construction.
Yep. No, I get you. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, George. Ed Stanek, I want to ask you about the forest fragmentation issue. Do you think this legislation is on the right track with that? Does it need to do more? Is it doing too much? What's your thought there?
It's not doing enough. I mean, idealistically, it does begin to address the important resources up there in the forest areas. But over the years, there's been a decrease in Act 250 jurisdiction. It comes back to that question of jurisdiction. Who needs to undergo a review? There's nothing really in the current bill which increases Act 250 review over these forest tracts of land. It presumes that there's already something that's going to trigger jurisdiction. To cut to the chase, you know, this is a wonderful discussion we're having, but it's not a substitute for meaningful public participation, which is severely restricted in the legislature due to the COVID-19 implications. So the forest fragmentation, in my mind, equals subdivision of land. Those large tracts of land and those high elevations, frankly, above 1,500 feet, have already 50 years ago been determined to be compelling state interests. The headwaters of rivers and streams, the aquifer recharge areas, the necessary habitat areas for different species, the travel corridors, and, again, the forest expanses up there. There's nothing in this bill which addresses it. It kicks the can down the road. The NRB, the Natural Resources Board, would be directed to promulgate rules, but it doesn't do anything to increase the scope of review. Some of us are extremely concerned about the 21st century challenges Vermont will face, which was touched upon in the Act 47 Legislative Committee report, but not really dealt with. What are we going to do when people begin migrating to Vermont because of climate change impacts where they currently are? There's going to be a lot of pressure put on those mountainsides. There's nothing in this bill now. The 2,000-foot elevation provision, which was in the House bill, was withdrawn before it even got to a final vote on the floor of the House. So what a sad comment that is. Trails, and I'll just make this one more comment.
It's ironic in a way that the environmental groups feel that there's no necessity for Act 250 oversight over new trail construction. Some of us can point to projects in the past where trails were built before they got the necessary permits, only because of Act 250 were impacts identified. And a good example is the Seine Basin Network in Facetown, where, ironically, VNRC fought the good fight to bring that under Act 250 jurisdiction. There, a big bear habitat was impacted by imprudent location of trails. So in a long-winded way, people's hearts are in the right place. I've known John Grogan for years. All these folks at VNRC, they're good friends. But we're rushing to judgment here. We should put the brakes on. When August comes, the legislature should deal with the very critical issues of budget and revenue streams, but not Act 250. Let's wait until January 2021. Roll up our sleeves and do this the right way.
Senator Christopher Bray is the chair of the Senate Natural Resources Committee. What do you think about that argument, Senator? You obviously would be, I suppose, a key player in putting the brakes on if you decided to do that. Is what Mr. Stanek is saying make sense?
Well, you know, I think there's two pieces to what Ed is sharing, and that is, one, it's complicated, and the process is never simple. When you're talking about Act 250, you're sort of in for an inch, you're in for a mile. And there's a lot of emotions tied to discussions around land and land use. So it's not surprising that it's not, there's no slam dunk on any of these things. But I think, you know, it's important. I mentioned that the first meeting of the Act 250 commissions, when the Senate wrote the provisions into that, creating that commission, we put legislators, the original proposal was to have a panel outside the legislature deliver recommendations. And we turned it around and said the panel will be all legislators, for House, for Senate, because in the end, we're the ones who are going to need to do the work. So let's put ourselves in the hot seat, and let's put ourselves front and center for doing that learning. So again, first meeting was back in September 20th of 2017. They delivered a report January 4 of 2019 to the legislature, to this biennium. And then that was our springboard into the bill that's been drafted in the House. Took more than a year to get to the Senate. And we were doing our own testimony, so we weren't waiting for the House bill to get there. We also took testimony based on all that commission work. So, you know, I appreciate that we always want more engagement, but, you know, that commission had 7 public meetings around the state. You know, 400 Vermonters provided direct testimony. We've had somewhere in the neighborhood of 180 people providing testimony, House and Senate, during this biennium. And, yes, I get it. COVID has made things harder. But because of Zoom meetings, but there has been, an unexpected bright side. I was looking at the statistics for our meetings, all electronic, since March 13th, and we've met 37 times. The meetings have been looked at by 2,504 times. So we're seeing an average of 68 people in a meeting. If you know our physical meeting room, we might have 8 to 14 in that room and be pretty packed. So a lot of people have been engaged. The process has been unfolding for 34 months now. And I feel pretty confident that we've done thorough work. Of course, Ed is right. There is more work to be done. John has said the same thing. We're not moving a perfect bill, but I think we're making balanced progress. And that's what I think, you know, we get elected to do, make balanced progress. We build provisions in, for instance, John Grobman mentioned them. If it turns out that we see a designated downtown process that's not delivering the kind of outcomes that we want, we don't think that it's merited, you know, we've also built in a de-designation process and an appeal process that said, you know what, it's not working the way we thought, it's not delivering adequate protection, we're not going to let you have that designation and leave Act 250 jurisdiction in certain ways. So I think we've built in some protections in it, and yet we're still trying to make progress.
John Groban, VNRC, what do you think about this argument from Ed Stanek that that the process ought to be basically put on hold? It's complicated legislation. We haven't had the normal legislative process in the Senate because of the COVID crisis. Should we give it another some more time and come back and address the thing in January?
I mean, like I said before, I think the bill has been pared down to issues that we have discussed for many years now, and it's the concentrating growth in certain designated areas, improving those programs, and basically implementing the smart growth principles that are in, they've been in the statutes for decades. And then, as I said, the forest issues, really, I don't think there's another issue that is more ripe. You know, we have debated the issue of adding a criteria to address fragmentation independent of the Commission on Act 250 in the legislature for at least 4 or 5 years. I think we're ready. I think people have raised the fact that there's going to be a rulemaking about implementing that criteria as a negative of how we're going to add forest protection to Act 250. But I think it'll provide more process. I think what the legislature is saying is that we've heard the debates, we've seen the studies, we know Act 250 has not adequately protected forests. We're going to add this criteria, and then we're going to have a rule-making process that people could participate in, that VNRC could participate in, and Ed could participate in, and anybody else wants to participate in it, and say that how that criteria is going to be implemented is going too far or not far enough, and there'll be more process. The same is true with trails. I want to make a point with regard to trails. You know, VNRC strongly believes that it is vitally important to regulate trail development, where it goes, the density of trails, and that's why we have participated in Act 250 over the years on jurisdictional questions related to trails. But our participation has shown that it's very hard to get Act 250 jurisdiction over trails. The case that Ed cited, you know, VNRC spent significant resources going through appeals, and they're hard cases to win. And what we're seeing now is trail groups have basically they're mostly not going through Act 250. So what we're trying to do is create a process that would have more review of trails in a way that would be outside of Act 250, but it would address the same issues: water quality and habitat and impacts on neighboring landowners. So I just think, and again, that's an issue where we've been discussing the trail issue again for a number of years. So I don't think that during this time of COVID and, the legislature is proposing to take all of H-926 that passed the House, which, as I said, had many, many more provisions in it than what Senator Bray is working on. I think that Senator Bray is working on a core set of issues, including issues that are important to some legislators from an economic response to COVID, including how we regulate in downtowns and housing issues that we have. So I do think that those issues are ripe. I think it's a small subset of the issues that we've been talking with Act 250. And as Senator Bray said, and I think Ed said as well, there's much more work to be done. This is the beginning. It's not the end. I agree with Ed that more needs to be done in terms of jurisdiction in areas outside of designated areas, and we'll continue to work on that. But that doesn't mean we take important steps forward now to begin to protect these resources, and deal with some of the issues that, we know exist with how Act 250 works.
Okay. Let's bring in a listener who's on the line, Jim from Barrie. Good morning, Jim.
Hi, good morning. Good morning to your guests. I just wanted to bring up an umbrella issue that I think should always be part of this discussion. And so I'm wondering how much consideration has been given along the way to not trigger both the U.S. Constitution and the Vermont Constitution on public takings of private land. And if you would review that or you could cite those for us, that would be helpful as well. I'm not saying this triggers it, but it should always be part of that discussion. And at what point will it trigger it, in your opinion? I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Let me go to Senator Bray. Property taking, when does Act 250 cross that line?
Sure. And John Grobin's a lawyer, so he probably can offer some legal analysis. I can't. But in short, you know, the Constitution protects private property, but it always says that it's that it has a public component to it. You know, that, for instance, all the wildlife in Vermont is spread across the entire landscape and owned by all of us. Water is held in common trust. So the Constitution in Chapter 1, Article 1 says private property. Article 2 says, but it's also we need to allow for public considerations related to private property. And when there's a taking, you should be compensated. But there's a lot of case law that says that conditioning the use of your land, especially as your use of your land will have an impact on others and things held in common, like water, air, wildlife, is not a taking. So we keep that in mind. I can assure the caller that this is, we're always making sure that we try to take a balanced approach to what we do. But I think
okay.
There's ample case law to say, yeah, when your activities have impacts on others and resources held in common, then
yep.
Then there's a legitimate conversation there, and that's what we do.
A public role, yeah. I want to move along
can I just address that really quickly? Just to
sure.
say, and
yep.
there's been, as the Senator Brandy, there's a lot of case laws. This would fall under the category of what's called a regulatory taking. And there's a lot of case law at the U.S. Supreme Court, from the U.S. Supreme Court. And basically, it's very hard to, if you have a legitimate regulatory program that's protecting, addressing issues in the public interest, and the regulation does not deprive a property owner of any use of the property, it's very difficult to establish a taking. There was in the early days of Act 250 challenges, taking challenges to Act 250, which failed. Ed Stanek can talk more about that. I don't, you know, MP was probably working in Act 250 when those challenges were brought.
Mm-hmm.
But I know they were not successful.
We just have a few minutes to go, and I did want to bring in one more listener who's on the line, and that is John from Callis. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I realize time is short. Something that's not been discussed, at least on your program today, Dave, is the loss of checks and balances when one exempts a projects, say, in my case in point, I'm going to roll out, Stowe, from had the Stowe build-out in the 90s been exempted from 250, which, by the way, this law would result in projects like that possibly being exempt, or projects in big tourist towns being exempt, where they have zoning and subdivision regs. The case in point is Stowe proposed an expansion to their sewage plant to accommodate a business they're friendly to, the Stowe Mountain Corporation. The expansion of the sewage plant was rubber-stamped by the Agency of Natural Resources. The Dean administration was 110% behind the expansion. And the result of that expansion, expanded sewage plant, would have been to see greater impacts to the Little River, more pollution to the river. There were treatment technologies that could address that, but A&R did not want to require the town of Stowe to spend the money. It was only because of Act 250 and the District 5 Environmental Commission and sworn testimony under oath, both of witnesses, expert witnesses, and subpoenaed, or under threat of subpoena, A&R witnesses, who then said, yeah, we could have done better, but we issued this permit because why? Governor Dean wanted us to.
Okay, John, I got to cut you off right there because we are just about out of time here, and I appreciate your call, and I wish we had time to get some responses from our guests, but I think we're going to have to revisit this topic on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM in the near future because there's a lot here, and so I appreciate the guests, John Grobin from PNRC, Senator Christopher Bray, as well as Ed Stanek, longtime Act 250 administrator. Thank you, the three of you, very much for joining me this morning. That is about it for today's program here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. Yes, we will be back, despite the fact that tomorrow's sort of a holiday, July 3rd. And listen, check us out again tomorrow morning. Have a good day, afternoon, everybody.